You're listening to The Leonard LoPage Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
By 2050, the United States is projected to be a majority-minority country, and although our nation's demographics are rapidly changing, some would argue that our public policies and our discussions about race have not been keeping pace. These issues were the focus of a book called Uncommon Common Ground, Race in America's Future, which was published in 2002. It's recently been reissued in a revised and updated form by W.W. Norton, and I'm pleased that it brings two of its contributors, Angela Glover-Blackwell, founder and CEO of Policy Link, and Manuel Pastor, professor of American Studies and Ethnicity at the University of Southern California, to our show today. Hello.
Hello.
Actually, I said something wrong here. The original title of the book was Searching for the Uncommon Common Ground. What's led to the title change 8 years later, Angela?
When we framed it as searching 8 years ago, we were still laying out the landscape of what's changing and what impact will it have. Now we see a sharp change. The election of Obama as president of the United States, the clarity coming into everyone's consciousness about the shifting demographics, and the economic crisis really framing everything in pretty sharp relief. So we thought it was time to be clearer and more exact that the only thing that's going to help us as a nation is the uncommon common ground.
Is there one place in the United States today with an ethnic makeup similar to what the country is projected to look like in 2050?
Yes, we
have Queens, New York, of course. Manuel?
Well, that would be California. You know, California's demographic change between the years 1980 and 2000 is roughly the demographic change that the United States is going to go through between the year 2000 and 2050. And as you know, that last 20 years in California's history was actually one riven with a lot of racial conflict around issues like immigration and affirmative action, but also the formation of a lot of very interesting multi-ethnic coalitions around living wage. Around new metropolitan strategies, et cetera. So I think the cauldron that's been California actually gives us both reasons to know that we need to do a lot of work, but also some reasons for hope. And this demographic change is coming quicker than even the 2050 numbers you're talking about, because by the year 2023, the majority of folks under the age of 18 will be people of color. And demographers are saying it's either this year or next year that the majority of births will be to people of color. So this is a change coming, happening right now.
Now, the third author of this book is Stuart Kuo, founding president and executive director of the Asian Pacific American Legal Center, also in California, Los Angeles. I guess the three of you thought, gee, California is unique, but there are other places. I mentioned Queens, for example, which may be the most ethnically diverse place in the world, and it seems to be handling it quite well. Do you think that at times racial tensions are exacerbated because people are constantly interacting with people from different backgrounds?
I think the more we interact, the better we get at it. And so I think that there are lots of places. I'm glad you mentioned Queens, but there are lots of places around the country where the majority of people are people of color. And we are probably getting better as a nation in terms of our interpersonal relationships, but policies, inequity, inequality looms large.
And I get the feeling that talking about race makes most Americans uncomfortable.
Yeah, you know, what we say in the book is that it tends to make whites uncomfortable because they fear they might say the wrong thing. And it tends to make people of color uncomfortable because we think that that'll be the only prism through which we're seen. But I think the point Angela's making is very critical. And one of the things that the book, we hope, does quite well is point out the gap between changes in attitudes, such that we've had a black president elected, and we see so many African-Americans and Latinos and Asians in media, et cetera, and the economic statistics, because there's really been very little progress on closing the racial gaps in terms of income and outcomes over the last 20 years.
So you think that there is a change, that people are more willing to talk about race, but how much significance should we read into claims by people like Glenn Beck and others that the president is a racist?
Oh, please.
I mean, isn't that also talking about race?
I think that what we need to talk about in terms of talking about race is to understand that the future of the nation depends on how the people who will make up the future fare. And the conversation about race is not name-calling or baring one's soul. The conversation about race is understanding that we can see our future now, and it's 5 years old. It's children who are 5 years old who are Black and Latino and Asian who are eager to learn and hoping to be a part of the nation. And so to the degree that we understand that many of them will be left behind if we don't change our education policy, our job training policy, and help the nation to become a 21st century economy, that conversation and that awareness leads us into policy and action that will ultimately create a fully inclusive society.
What do the polls indicate about whether most minorities and whites believe race relations in America are changing and improving? Manuel?
Well, I think if you look at the polls, what you find is that there's been an increased willingness to consider candidates of different races for positions. And there is, you know, increased sense of friendships, et cetera, across racial lines. But again, I think we need to focus in on the policy questions as well. And getting back to Glenn Beck for a second, you know, the title of this book, Uncommon Common Ground, really is intentional because we think that some people tend to go for the least common denominator, that people like Glenn Beck are going for the least common denominator of racial division and pointing out, tensions. And that sometimes people who are progressive and of goodwill go for the least common denominator in terms of saying, oh, yes, we have to, you know, pay attention to the needs of everyone and educate all our children, et cetera. What we're saying is we do need to do those things, but we have to be paying attention to race and racial differences in the process. And one of the warning signs of this is what we did during the last great economic period of turmoil, the Great Depression, in which we devised, you know, what looked like great strategies to promote home ownership, but they tended to promote home ownership only for whites and in white-only communities. We came up with a Wagner Act to protect labor rights, but it didn't protect agricultural workers, and so it left Latinos and Asians and African Americans behind. We came up with a Social Security system, which initially didn't cover agricultural or domestic workers, again, predominantly people of color. So as we begin to devise strategies to get out of our economic morass right now, we need to be paying attention to the racial inequities that exist so that we can make sure everybody can benefit from the eventual recovery.
My guests are Manuel Pastor, Professor of American Studies and Ethnicity at the University of Southern California, and Angela Glover Blackwell, founder and CEO of Policy Link. They are the authors, along with Stephen Kuo, of Uncommon Common Ground, Race and America's Future. You say, Angela, you write, my childhood was almost completely devoid of any awareness of racism. Why was that?
Yeah, I had the experience of growing up in St. Louis in the 1950s and 60s in the middle of an all-Black community in which the adults did everything they could to protect us from racism, and they did a good job. One part of the job was made easy because the places where we went to school and prayed and played were all Black. But they also exposed us to the best that St. Louis had to offer and made sure that they protected us there, too. It wasn't until I went away to college that I came to understand the value of being surrounded by these caring adults that literally created scaffolding that allowed us to be able to move up even as we were locked out of the mainstream. However, when I went away to college, it also became clear to me that I experienced the Black middle class. So many children who were Black and poor in St. Louis didn't have that experience, didn't go to college, and got the full force of racism. So I was fortunate, but it was a device that helped a few. It didn't help most.
And class is a big issue in this country, white or Black or Hispanic. A poor white kid is unlikely to aspire to go to a good school as a poor Black kid. But middle class people of all races, colors, creeds, etc., will consider that to be the only alternative for them.
There's no question that class matters and race matters, and when they come together, they really matter. And we have to make sure that we're doing what Manuel said, and that is, even as we're looking at poor people in this country, understanding that each person's journey is influenced by their experience and by the history. So the history and legacy of racism makes it particularly hard for a Black or Latino to be able to overcome poverty, though I don't mean to minimize poverty for anyone. Poverty is hard to overcome, but when you have the added burden of discrimination when you try to get a house or get a job, or you have the added burden of living in a community that's completely isolated from opportunity because of historical housing discrimination, you have a bigger burden.
Manuel, aren't you the son of immigrants? Let me ask this question, then you can continue. Because following up, you're the son of immigrants, aren't you? Did you encounter much racism in your childhood or during as you were establishing your professional career?
Well, you know, I did. It's kind of funny here. I am at a research university, and when I was in high school, I was not tracked to go to college. And then when I eventually went to college, I was not tracked to go to a research, to a PhD program. And when I was coming out of the PhD program, I was not tracked to go to a research university. And here I am, a full professor at one of the premier research universities in the country. So I ran into something. But I think that, you know, one of the things that was really formative for me was watching my father, as I talk about in the book, and I think one of the things that we call for in the book is for people to share their personal stories, because I think that's the way that people build the one-on-one relationships that allow us to talk honestly about race. But my dad came to the country in the 1930s with papers that were imperfect. When World War II came, he was given the choice between being deported or joining the U.S. Army. He couldn't figure out what to do, so he gave a penny to my cousin Carlitos, who flipped it. And he and the penny went to the war, and he came back a citizen. And he wound up being able, after the war, to access the GI Bill, to be able to go with a sixth grade education to a community college system, and then be able to move from being a janitor to being an electrician, and help move our family from being poor to being working class. And what that really made me aware of was the very tenuous situation that we have with so many immigrants who do not have access to all of the services that we think are important for people to get ahead. And, you know, the fact that we've got 11 million people in the country right now who lack papers, for whom we have no strategy of how they're going to be able to successfully integrate into the society, and we're not thinking about what that's doing for the kids. I mean, you know, imagine if my father had never been able to obtain papers and what a difference that would have made in his life and in mine. So we think that these are also very important issues. The one thing I wanted to add to what Angela was saying before was race matters, class matters, and place matters. You know, the Pew Research Center has been doing some great work on economic mobility, and one of the things they found was that 5% of white children grow up in poor neighborhoods. 60 to 70% of African-American children grow up in poor neighborhoods. It's not that 60 to 70% of African-American children are poor, but it is that they're growing up in poor neighborhoods with the issues that occur with regard to security, that occur with regard to school quality, et cetera. And so one of the ways in which racial inequality is being reproduced in the United States right now is by spatial inequality, and addressing the idea of making every place a place of opportunity is something we lift up quite a bit in the book.
My guests are Manuel Pastor, a professor of American Studies and Ethnicity and the director of the Program for Environmental and Regional Equity at the University of Southern California; Angela Glover, the founder and CEO of PolicyLink, a national research and action institute advancing economic and social equity. And they are the co-authors with Stuart Kuo, who is the founding president and executive director of the Asian Pacific American Legal Center in Los Angeles, of a book now recently revised and updated and renamed Uncommon Common Ground: Race and America's Future. It's published by W.W. Norton as part of their American Assembly book series. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Angela Glover Blackwell and Manuel Pastor, two of the three authors of a book that has been recently revised and updated called Uncommon Common Ground, Race and America's Future. It's published by Norton. And I guess you could keep on updating this because in some ways things will never change, and in other ways they will constantly change.
They will constantly change, and there are some things that will be with us for a long time. Racism and this uncomfortable living together predates the Constitution, that the racism that we're dealing with now is older than the country itself. And so it's going to be around for a long time. But one of the things that is particularly troublesome is that so many people, because they don't see it, so many people who are white in America and are doing okay, though nobody's doing that great right now, they don't see what's going on, and therefore they think it's gone away, and it hasn't. So one of the things that we hope this book will do is get people reading the data, looking at the disparities, understanding that the legacy of racism and continuing discrimination continue to create different realities for people in this country based on race and ethnicity, and it needs to be addressed.
Manuel, Latinos are now the largest minority group in the United States, so should we be surprised that the major racial flashpoint in America at the moment is Arizona's controversial immigration law?
Well, one of the things I think is also true about Arizona, and it's pretty significant, is its metro areas have the largest demographic gap between the old and the young. That is, the 80 to 85% of those above the age of 60 in Phoenix, for example, are white, and more than 50% of those below the age of 18 are people of color, mostly Latino. And it's that large demographic gap between the old and the young that's creating a sense of generational conflict as well. And we think that this is actually very significant. In fact, I think it's part of what, when people think about the Tea Party, what you're really seeing with that famous slogan, "Get your government hands off my Medicare," right, is the notion of lifting up the drawbridge just as new people are arriving to help make the country. And if you think about what led to our success as a country, it's certainly our individual initiative, but it's all of the different kinds of, labor guarantees and programs to help people buy houses and the investments in educational infrastructure that allowed the country to grow, and for so many older white working class and middle class and others to do well in the country. We have to continue to have those supports as we move forward. And so I think that part of what's going on in Arizona is the reaction, of course, to the issues of immigration and to the growth of the Latino population, but it's also really a function of this age gap. And one of the things we're going to have to do is create a way to talk about those generational conflicts.
But it's not just Arizona. Other states and cities have laws prohibiting the undocumented from receiving public benefits or driver's licenses. And during the health care debate, many argued that we had to make sure illegal immigrants wouldn't be covered.
I think it's important. Manuel, I just want to say, I think it's important to push forward that the immigration issue is a preeminent civil rights issue now. And one of the things we haven't seen enough of is African Americans embracing this immigration issue. And I think that we have to see more of that, because what we are experiencing, let's not try to sugarcoat it, is that we have a lot of fear and hate in the nation right now. And fear and hate often go together. African Americans have experienced that again and again in the history. And it is so important when you have that rising up, and it's usually a minority. It's usually a minority of people. It's not the whole nation, but you cannot ignore it, because if that catches hold and becomes the thing that sets policy and sets the agenda and begins to dominate in the media, we're headed in a bad direction. And so I think it's very important, and we try to talk about this in the book, that we recognize that we're going to go through a grown zone as a nation. Because the demographics are changing doesn't mean that all of a sudden everything is going to be fine. We're going to go through this period of people being afraid, ugly things going on, but hopefully we will understand that we have to start acting as if we can ignore a future that is inevitable and begin to invest in the strategies and policies that will create a whole nation.
Well, haven't ideas about what constitutes a minority and what constitutes a white person in America shifted dramatically over the years? Weren't Italians and Irish and Jewish immigrants not considered white when they first arrived in America in large numbers?
Yes, you know, it's interesting. It was a process, I think, after the war, World War II, both through the experience of the nation coming together for the war and as a result of the creating of the suburbanization that people call the kind of whitening of America in terms of the groups you're talking about. And I think it raises a very important issue that we try to talk about honestly in the book, which is, you know, what are Latinos going to go through that process? And is this going to create tensions in the future and current tensions with African Americans? So one of the things that when you hear Angela, for example, calling on African-American leaders to pay attention to these really key issues of immigration and immigrant integration and civil rights issues, we're issuing equally strong calls for Latino leadership and immigrant leadership to pay attention to what the civil rights legacy and history is in the United States and what the current problems of African-Americans are as well. You know, these are the two communities, Latino and African Americans, that are living in the closest proximity in our urban areas. And if we can figure out how to make sure that we understand each other's histories, each other's issues, and have each other's backs, then I think we can really create a coalition that can create a much better future for all of America.
During the 2008 election, there was a lot of conjecture about whether Barack Obama was going to carry the Latino vote. It actually didn't pan out, but there were debates because Latinos are also seen as being split politically, aren't they?
Well, I think that's true. You know, one of the things I think that it was very clearly a misreading of the Latino vote is the Latino vote has also been quite loyal. And the Clintons had actually made really pretty tremendous progress for Latinos. And so it was no surprise that Hillary Clinton in her run got very significant Latino support. And I must say that I was quite, as someone more versed in the community and more versed in the politics, knew that that the commentators and pundits had it wrong from the beginning. But I think it's very important right now to help cement that alliance, to make some progress on this issue of comprehensive immigration reform. That is what Latinos are looking for from the administration right now, and see it as important not just for immigrants, but for all Latinos. I mean, one of the things that SB 170, the law in Arizona, made clear is that the rest of the nation is not always distinguishing between immigrants, documented or undocumented, and not distinguishing between immigrants and native-born Latinos. Everyone is going to be subject to racial profiling as a result of that law.
Although Governor Jan Brewer denies that's going to be the case, she says that law enforcement officers will be trained to not engage in racial profiling. Is that possible?
I don't think it's possible. Clearly, they have been living in this country. They've been subjected to all the stereotypes and other things that everybody else has been subjected to, and I think we all know what will happen.
My guests are Angela Glover Blackwell and Manuel Pastor, two of the three authors of a book called Uncommon Common Ground. It is published by Norton. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Angela, you said that you'd like to see more African-Americans get involved in the whole immigration issue, but aren't an awful lot of African-Americans concerned that illegal immigrants are going to compete for the same jobs that they go after?
It comes up. It comes up all the time. We particularly hear about it when you're doing local work, which is a lot of the work that I do. And that is why African-American leaders, both locally and nationally, need to make sure the data is there, that we are actually dealing with the facts and we understand how our destinies are intertwined, and that this is one of a package of issues that are very much 21st century issues. And when you look at all of the issues together, you will see that if we could pursue them, we would make a huge difference. We're talking about comprehensive education, really dealing with the issue of creating 21st century employment opportunities for people who are often left behind, dealing with incarceration that's hitting Black and Latino males particularly hard, and making sure that when people come out, they're reintegrated into community. Climate change, so much of the climate change impact hits people who are poor and vulnerable, and so we need to embrace that issue and look for climate change equity. And building healthy metropolitan communities is one that would improve life for so many. In the metropolitan areas where we live, we have the issues of making sure that we have public transportation systems that link everybody to opportunity, that we're dealing with the obesity crisis in Black and Latino communities and helping to have grocery stores that sell fresh fruits and vegetables broadly available to every community and making sure that the streets are safe and people can get out and exercise. And so when you look at the basket of issues that are the 21st century issues, the immigration issues and the immigrant integration issues fit right there, and we have to help people see them. All of those things I listed, they aren't immediately on the tongues of those people who say, what are the issues?
Have any of these concerns been addressed in talking about how we're going to reform financial services?
Well, this is also a very significant problem as well. And one of the things I think that we need to be paying significant attention to is the way in which so many Black and Latino homeowners were led into the subprime market. And if you look at the data on this, and we talk about it in the book, many African Americans and Latinos who could have qualified for conventional loans were instead given subprime mortgages. And these were the kind of mortgages that were the most likely to become to go belly up in the context of the initial wave of the housing crisis. And one of the things that we say in the book is that, you know, we really as a nation became increasingly unequal, so that we had one group of people who were so wealthy they were forced to speculate, and another group of people who were so stressed financially they were borrowing just to stay alive. That when the financial that financial kind of craziness all played through a very unregulated market in which we had derivatives in the stock market, and we had subprime loans in the mortgage market. And when the first people began to lose their homes, and they were Black and Latino homeowners, often in far-reaching suburbs, people did not see that as the canary in the mine, but thought it was someone else's problem. We were very disconnected, and so we didn't pay attention. We were very deregulated, and so we wound up with a crisis. And we were very unequal, and that's what drove the crisis. And so as we move forward, we think that it's very central to reconnect ourselves, to think about the appropriate regulations, and most importantly, I know Angela can speak quite eloquently about this, to have equity be our guiding principle around policy.
The financial reform will help everybody, including low-income people of color, just as health reform has done the same thing.
What about the stimulus plan?
The stimulus is exactly where I wanted to go, because what we also need to do is to make sure that as we're trying to stimulate the economy, we target those who've been hit first and worst. And while racial targeting probably is not going to happen, there is no reason why we can't target those census tracts where we have the highest unemployment. Manuel talked earlier about class matters, race matters, and place matters, and the fact that place looms so large as a proxy for race and class intersecting. We can use place as a way to target resources so that we're pushing jobs into those communities, pushing job training into the institutions that serve those communities. Because the stimulus has helped a lot, but it hasn't been as targeted as we need. So going forward, we need to make sure that jobs becomes the number one area where we see improvement. Infrastructure investments would make a huge difference. So many people in America are left behind because they live in places that have been left behind. We need to target infrastructure investments, make sure people who live there get those jobs, and that we're training people for a 21st century economy.
Well, we have in this health plan undocumented workers not being covered. So I don't know if that is similar to what you were talking about earlier with the New Deal policies that somehow overlooked Blacks and Hispanics. But I'm sure that there are an awful lot of listeners out there who think that somebody who is undocumented shouldn't be covered. What's the argument for covering them?
Go ahead, Manuel.
Well, you know, let me just say that this is one of those examples where fear and hate drive stupid policy, because, you know what, it's not a question of whether undocumented workers would have been covered by federal subsidies. I think everyone assumes they would not receive federal benefits for that. What the health care reform did was make it illegal for someone who is undocumented to buy private insurance in one of those exchanges. And what that means is that even if an undocumented person has sufficient money to purchase health insurance, they're going to be forbidden from being able to do that. And the problem with that, of course, is that two. One is that, you know, if they can't buy private insurance, they're going to wind up in our public hospitals and will wind up paying for it through that. And also, these are exactly the kind of people you want to have buy into private health insurance because they tend to be younger, healthier, et cetera, and that's who you want to help subsidize the older people who are in the pool. So this is one of these cases where fear, hate, really drives bad policy. I think that people can have all sorts of arguments about what access to services people who currently lack papers should have or not. But I think all of us know that if we have 11 million people who are in the country who have been working and making their lives here, and it's very unrealistic and draconian to expect that we can deport those people, we need to have some kind of workable solutions that create a pathway to legalization for these people who have been contributing to our economy. And what really makes, what I guess burns me right now is listening to people talk about how somehow this has had a negative impact on our economy. You know, it's not 11 million undocumented people who drove us into a financial crisis. It was several thousand unregulated stockbrokers who did that. And I think we've begun, you know, if we really want to get out of this crisis, we're going to have to put regulation in the right place in our financial markets and then try to create an orderly system for immigration in the future, an orderly system for a pathway to legalization for those who are already here, and an orderly system to protect our borders in the future.
That's right.
I just want to ask the two of you one more thing before you go about the impact this is having on our political system. There are many people in the Republican Party who are concerned that some of the positions being taken by leading Republicans are going to drive away all potential Latino voters for a long time. The similar arguments were made about African Americans, and yet this year I think we're seeing more and more African American Republicans running for office than we have in a long time. So will this have a long-lasting impact, do you think?
I think that we will see that these draconian policies, this hateful language, this selfishness will drive Latinos and African Americans and people who want to see a better future away from the Republican Party. And that should be a concern to them. I actually think that the fact that we're seeing African Americans running for office has nothing to do with African Americans flocking to the Republican Party. I mean, you can count them on your fingers. Maybe you might need 10 fingers, maybe 20. But whatever the numbers are, they don't
count the members of the Supreme Court on one finger.
That's true. And you don't see people who are Black and Latino running in that direction. So I don't think that you're going to attract Blacks and Latinos with those kind of policies. But here's what I really predict for America. I think that the American people are better than they are often seen when it comes to these kinds of issues. I think the American people see themselves as being inclusive, and they are turned off by this kind of hate language and this exclusive attitude. What we will see is that when it comes time to vote, people are going to have to look deep into their souls. And when they look deep into their souls, I think that we will see the American people making the right choice. But it's up to the media to make sure the American people have the right information. You can't have a soundbite election period and expect people to be intelligent voters. If the media gets the right information out there, we'll see the American people making the right choices, because I think that most of them want to do the right thing.
So, Manuel, you think the Democrats are going to hold on to the majority in Congress? Everybody's predicting a major change.
Well, I think it's quite possible to be a major change. I think in difficult economic times, people tend to react to who's in power and blame them for that. And the recovery has not been as rapid as we would have hoped. With regard to the, you know, I mean, it's very clear that in California, after Proposition 187, which was the sort of forerunner of Arizona's kind of legislation, that Latinos flocked away from the Republican Party. And when I talk to Latino Republicans right now, they're just very uncomfortable with the direction the party has taken. But one thing I think is extraordinarily interesting is there was a poll done in California asking about the kinds of restrictions that have been happening in Arizona and the level of support for them. There was a racial difference that you might expect. Latinos were less likely to be in favor of restrictive legislation, African Americans as well. But the biggest difference, even controlling for race, was between older Californians and younger Californians. So I think just as Angela was talking about, American people are better than this and they will reject this, one of the things that's very clear is that young people feel that these are not the kinds of policies that they think make sense. For them, they grow up with people around them who may have papers, who may not have papers, and they see that they are part of their communities. And they begin to realize that we really need to move in a different direction. And I think one of the things that gives us tremendous hope, and one of the reasons why the book, despite bringing up the problems of disparities and the policy issues that we do, ends with a message of such hope, is that we really do think the American people are better than people are giving them credit for, and we see tremendous wisdom in what people are doing in their communities, and we see tremendous energy for something better amongst our young people who are looking for leadership, and they're looking for us to model a different kind of conversation about race and a different kind of conversation about the future of America.
My great thanks to you, Manuel Pastor and Angela Glover-Blackwell, co-authors along with Stuart Quo of Uncommon Common Ground, Race and America's Future. It's published by Norton.